Hello everyone, welcome to the Keen on Yoga podcast. Another solo episode today, so I hope you like it. It's just me. Today's episode though is one that's dear to my heart and probably dear to yours as well. It's on the modern Mysore tradition, so the modern tradition of Ashtanga Yoga, and it is a modern tradition. I know that probably we want to think of it as 5,000 years old, and you know, we'll come to that about the Yoga Kurunta and the mythological figure of the Brahma Mohan Brahmacharya in the cave. We'll come to that. But for now, let's start at the beginning and let's talk about Krishna early days in the Mysore Palace. So this is where we can definitely say that we start to see a dynamic form of yoga emerging. Previous to that, Vyasa, if I got that right, or the Shatavanidhi scripts, texts in the yoga in the Mysore Palace Library do suggest in the way that the asanas that are structured in the text that there's some movement between, but no one's really teaching dynamically before Krishna. At the very same time, Sri Yogendra in Mumbai is also starting to teach dynamically. He finds, you know, Sri Yogendra is probably the first modern yoga teacher, as much as he teaches public classes before Krishnamacharya, who was teaching, you know, a select group of boys in the Mysore Palace. But anyway, so, and also I would suggest that Swami Kavali is also teaching dynamically. In fact, some people say that Krishnamacharya gets the sun salutations off Kavali. So these three figures at the start of the 20th century are modernizers of asana tradition because they're bringing in a flowing dynamic form of yoga, which was previous to that static, although there are texts that suggest possibly, and then the Mysore Library, and there's been, you know, or a few libraries, that there was movement in the asana tradition before that. There's tenuous records. There's no teachers doing it. There's tenuous records of anything, and it's only suggested that there's movement, you know, although it's very likely. Anyway, so Krishnamacharya is probably the roots of it, and the modern asana tradition as a dynamic and not a static tradition. As I say, the tantric roots of the practice were always static. You held a few asanas for longer periods of time with strong breathing and strong bandhas. Nothing to do with the, well, nothing to do, but a very different landscape than the modern asana tradition that we've inherited from Krishnamacharya. So coming back to the Mysore Palace, he taught there from roughly 90, and people will correct me, I'm sure, as you always do, which is good. We share, we learn. 1930, I'm going to say, to roughly 1950. I believe he stopped in 1948. I don't exactly know where he commenced. But his mantle, his job from the Maharaj of Mysore, was to teach young boys. So he taught accordingly. And when he went to Chennai, of course, when he moved to Chennai after the Mysore Palace, he didn't teach young boys and he taught accordingly again. And he never taught this moving dynamic style of Ashtanga after those years in the Mysore Palace. So it's to be suggested that there was nothing specific about the sequences themselves that were particularly dear to Krishnamacharya's heart. And perhaps we'll move on to that in a second. But I mean, essentially, the Mysore Palace, he had a specific job remit, right? Teach young teenage boys, because they were boys at the time, the Brahmin boys that were coming, a challenging form of movement that would keep their attention. And also, there was this kind of, there's always a political context. There was a political context that Maharaj of Mysore was a Indian nationalist, well, as much as he was fighting for Indian independence against the British, not necessarily nationalist exactly, but you know, he's fighting for this independence and he was wanting to promote Indian culture, especially ones with the give Indian men strong physical prowess against these kind of emasculating English presence. So there was a political lobby to the promotion of physical Indian traditions. And he also, I mean, next door he gave the room to a bodybuilder, V.K. Iyer, I believe was his name. And, you know, that wing of the Mysore Palace next door to Krishnamacharya was this bodybuilding gym. And there, Iyer also used yoga within his modality. So there probably was a bit of crossover there. And moving on from there, the asanas in the Sri Tattvanidhi or the Yoga Hatha Vyasa Padati, the text that's maybe slightly comes, I think, I say after, correct me if I'm wrong, after or before the Tattvanidhi, they're at, you know, 1850s-ish, right? 1800s, 1850s. These two texts that people believe that Krishnamacharya borrowed the postures from, because there isn't that much of a broad spectrum of postures before that. Even they don't teach a lot of the postures that we know now today. I mean, notably, downward dog isn't there. Upward dog is a kind of cobra. It's not upward dog as we know it. So, you know, and many other postures. So, you know, it's likely that Krishnamacharya did innovate and did bring in a lot of postures, which is neither here nor there. But I mean, it's as much to say that there's no certain divine legislation that goes with the postures themselves, perhaps, let's say. And the sequences, well, I've mentioned that a little bit. And people will dispute this. And, you know, it's just an idea, a hypothesis that Krishnamacharya and Batabi Joyce came up with the sequences for the express purpose of using them as demonstrations when they had to demonstrate. And Maharaj of Mysore would often want demonstrations for the general public because he was trying to raise morale. Remember, it was a political agenda here, you know, using yoga, raise morale in the Indian public. And he was using these sequences for the general public to, you know, as a spectacle. And it always makes sense if you're going to make a spectacle, you know, to make all the boys do the same thing. Yeah. So these sequences, and this is a hypothesis, again, you may disagree, but these sequences are likely to have come about as the work of Krishnamacharya and Batabi Joyce at this time for the demonstrations to give a good demonstration, a good spectacle. But were they taught in the Mysore Palace? No. I mean, and there's Dr. Sharma and other notables have attested for this, that everyone started off, I think Dr. Sharma, and he's still alive, and so I've tried to get him on the podcast as of yet, to no avail. He's old now. No excuses. But you know, he attests that you could start off with the sun salutations, but after that you were free. I think he says something exactly along those lines. Everyone started off with the sun salutations, but after that they were free to do as they pleased, and they were given different things because Krishnamacharya's ultimate premise, I think, more than anything else, was yoga is individually adapted. Yoga must be adapted to each individual body, and therefore they were taught that way. The kids were taught that way, adapting it to their capacity and not following the set of sequences that we know now. So it's not to say they're not useful, but I mean, I think just to see that this tradition of Ashtanga, the modern Ashtanga tradition that we often think is pinned to the sequences, you know, getting the sequences right, or the, you know, the preservation of the literal preservation of the exact details of the sequences, even nowadays, you know, the specific pedantry, let's say, of this detail, hold your foot this way, bind this way. These are recent innovations, and there's a general method. And my thrust of argument is there's a general method behind these sequences, behind this teaching, that's Krishnamacharya's method. But it's not the sequences themselves. They're not a magic ritual. You know, do them right for a number of years and, you know, get the stamp from your teacher and then get enlightenment because you've done them right. It's a magic combination, like I always say. They're not that. And the pedantry that goes, oh, you've got to bind with the left wrist or take, that's a new thing. That never, you know, that was never there. You know, that's come more recently and for other reasons, you know, for that we maybe go on to later or maybe not. But, you know, my view of the Ashtanga method is it's, you know, it has historical roots, that maybe it's not to be literally interpreted as the sequences. Although I was going to mention this before, there's this thing of Yoga Karunta. Right? You know, you might have heard of that. The myth that Krishnamacharya presents, or we call it a myth, but, you know, he latterly, I think almost on his, you know, his last years, he kind of, I think when Desikachar asked him about the Yoga Karunta and the guru, Rama Mohan Brahmachari, his guru that he went to visit in Tibet and stayed with for a number of years. It sounds like the movie, doesn't it? You know, this is the legend. You know, he stayed with this guru. This guru gave him the mythical Yoga Karunta. I say mythical, the text Yoga Karunta, maybe it's not. And it had the Ashtanga sequences recorded there, right? And he stayed and he studied. And then when he left, the guru said, well, no, it's tradition to ask the guru, in fact, what do you want for the service? You never asked before. They teach you for seemingly for free, but it's a loaded, you know, there's always a payment at the end. And it's like, what do you want? And he asked Rama Mohan Brahmachari. This is Krishnamacharya. This is the legend. And Rama Mohan Brahmachari said, well, I want you to teach the general public yoga. They're not hide it anymore. Because previous to that, obviously, he'd gone to visit this yogi in a cave and taught, you know, and was lived there and was taught secretively one to one. So anyway, this is the story. And, you know, Krishnamacharya called his method the Yoga Karunta. So there's this Yoga Karunta thing lying around. Did it happen? Modern scholars suggest that doesn't match up. The time periods don't match up for this or that reason. In a kind of, in a practical sense, you know, they can almost prove that You know, Krishnamacharya didn't go and spend all this time in Tibet with this. I don't want to say that, you know, because I can't remember exactly what text I'm referring to. Well, I mean, the Modern Path of Yoga, you can read it in there. Modern Path of Yoga, I think there's some explanation. Definitely a Norman Soyman's book, Traditions of the Mysore Palace. He suggests that actually Krishnamacharya went kind of down the road in Karnataka, and there was an ashram, and he learned some things from a tantric master there, yoga, asana-wise. Anyway, Niyoga Karunta, no one's ever seen it. Well, Pattabhi Joyce was apparently taken with Krishnamacharya. Krishnamacharya took him to the Calcutta library, where there was one. There's a copy of the Yoga Karunta there, apparently. But it was in a bad condition, mainly eaten by ants or rats or whatever, and which is possible, fairly feasible for these old manuscripts in the library, right? Under humid conditions. But subsequently, no one's seen it. Pattabhi Joyce claimed to have seen it. And he also mentions the story of Krishnamacharya's guru. But yeah, I mean, you know, so this is the idea that Ashtanga has, you know, is a very ancient practice, and it goes back maybe to Ramanuja of the 12th century. This is another idea, right? But, you know, whether it does or doesn't, if the proof is in the pudding, I suppose that's my bottom, you know, line in this podcast. Does it work for you, right? Now, does a tradition need to be 5,000 words if it doesn't work? If I'm years old, if it doesn't work? You know, if it's 20 years old and it works, then it's a valuable tradition. I mean, what does tradition mean in the first place? It means a pattern or a way of doing things. Or actually, what it means in Latin is transdare, to bring across, to carry across. So this idea of preserving a kind of general kind of information and then making it fresh and new to specifics, this in my mind is tradition. So it has to be made effective to the modern context, right? Yoga is very context sensitive. I like that expression. It wasn't mine, context sensitive yoga. But it is, you know, the modern era, that tradition has to be made fresh again, you know, just like it was made fresh by Krishnamacharya, who, you know, and at that time, you know, obviously Krishnamacharya is a you know, traditional Brahmin man. He's also an innovator. He's also a very modern innovator who was interested in women's issues and women's health issues and teaching women. You know, the very modern, but also a very traditional kind of character. And as a Brahmin, traditional Brahmin, basically he was a very high up priest. I mean, he could have been the head of a monastery, in a very important monastery in Mysore, but he rejected the title. His family is a very noble lineage, let's say. But, so he was traditional, and you know, as a Brahmin, you can't innovate. You can't be seen to be invented stuff, because everything is sacred, right? It comes from God. So, you know, he had to find a precedent for these teachings. So, you know, he kind of created one, perhaps. I mean, other people will say that the Karunta is a little bit like the text, the Yoga Karuntaka. There's a text, the Yoga Karuntaka, but it doesn't teach the sequences, the Ashtanga sequences. And if you look in Krishnamacharya's book, you know, his first book on yoga asana, the Yoga Makaranda, which is great. Get it as a PDF. It's easy. You could download it. Super easy. Just put it into Google. Doesn't teach the sequences either. Does teach dynamic yoga. Does teach vinyasa. Is interested in vinyasa, but not interested in the exact number of counts necessarily, or the way that postures link together. I mean, what he's interested in is, you know, Krishnamacharya is interested in three principles. And listen carefully, because these are, I think, important. Individually based yoga, one. Second thing is posture, counter posture. There's a name for that. People, correct me, please. I can't remember the name. Tell me it. it has a Sanskrit name. Posture. So every posture, if you look at Krishnamacharya's charts at the end of his book, every posture has a posture. Goes through very methodically, posture, counter posture. There's really this interplay consistently, which we don't get in modern Ashtanga, although we can kind of see the remnants of it in certain postures. When you do one thing, the most obvious example that comes to mind is forward fold, followed by, in the primary series, Purvottanasana, the backward stretch. You know? So there's examples of this throughout, but it's not easy to kind of see them, as it is in Krishnamacharya's original sequences. That he makes, in the back of the Makaranda, he basically makes some kind of, you know, examples of sequences, right? But he's clear to say that this should be tailored to the individual based on posture, counter posture, and structured so it builds. You know, so you start off at a basis and you kind of build up extrapolating on that basis. You know, kind of idea that was carried on by his son, Desikachar. Taught Vinayoga, TKV Desikachar. And the book, if you haven't read it, Heart of Yoga by TKV. I think it was co-authored by Mark Whitwell, I believe. Great book, really good. And just gave a good flavor of the teachings of Krishnamacharya as he developed after the Mysore Palace, which, as I said, you know, the Ashtanga tradition comes from this particular job I would say job manifesto. It's not exactly that. Job remit or job requirement. You know, here you are, your Maharaj of Mysore. So here you are, Krishnamacharya. Teach these young boys, make them interested, you know, make sure they keep their interest and they're young, so they're going to move dynamically, you know, and accordingly. I mean, another thing that's always like bugbear, I'm sorry to mention this, is accordingly, of course, he adjusts them into postures because they're young and supple, you know. And then, you know, the Pattabhi Joyce is innovating the Krishnamacharya method even further, because he's taking this method of adjusting young boys and, you know, dynamic postures to adjusting adults and dynamic postures, which is obviously two very different things, as we might know. So, you know, that precedent for adjustments, you know, Krishnamacharya never carries on after the Mysore Palace. You know, he's teaching much more therapeutically and much more methodically and individually based, you know, and he's not adjusting students as he was there. I'm sure of that, you know, the way that he writes subsequent to that. So, yeah, I mean, take that as you want, as you will. But I don't feel that the precedent of adjustments that Pattabhi Joyce really almost invents to adjust an adult body in that manner, in that forceful manner, is a relevant way to approach to modern our modern Ashtanga tradition as it is. And just to say it's a modern tradition doesn't mean it's wrong or bad or less valid. It just means know the context, know the roots, know the and treat it pragmatically, that it's not. We can use the general methods, you know. I mean, there's very useful reasons for vinyasa. Again, Krishnamacharya, there's no mention of vinyasa in the same way that Krishnamacharya uses it. We could say Krishnamacharya is innovated on vinyasa. Of course, he'll find an old precedent. You can look at the Krishnamacharya's bibliography in the Makaranda. And he lists a whole bunch of texts that he says are the precedent for his teaching. You know, as a Brahmin, you have to find it. You can't just kind of make something out of your samskaras. You have to teach traditionally. But you know, there was a huge amount of innovation there, and particularly what Krishnamacharya wanted to do was he wanted to kind of bring together the classical strains of yoga vis-a-vis Patanjali, this kind of idea about following the Dharma, following Yama, Niyama, and incorporating aspects of meditation and pranayama into the asana, in a kind of whole package kind of way for as a lifestyle, I suppose. And the tantric method, which he clearly mentions in the Makaranda as well, which is, you know, much more kind of how would I say it, less socially acceptable, I suppose, which because it's a little bit more kind of esoteric, a little bit more mystical, a little bit more kind of contrary to norm, you know, because what you're trying to do is kind of raise energy in the body to create a super powerful body. And he's looking at asana in this manner, and often he'll describe the asana in its energetic context, like you do this, for example, Janushirshasana B. You do straight foot forward if you remember sitting on the heel doing Janushirshasana. Yep, you do a straight foot forward if you're doing tantric yoga, if you're doing hatha yoga, tantric hatha yoga is tantric yoga, or if you're doing raja yoga, if you're using the posture for meditational purposes, you know, for concentrating the mind, you know, sense withdrawal, then you're doing the foot to the side, you're changing, you know. So he's very specific that there's these two strains of you can see this in throughout the text, there's these two strains of kind of perspective on yoga. One is a classical perspective on the body where you sit in a posture for a period of time and you withdraw the senses and you meditate, right? And you use the posture as an ass, as a seat. And the other is a tantric perspective where you're using the postures to generate an energy in the body. And it's, you know, it is a different thing. And it comes later, you know, it comes later in the trajectory of a Indian evolution of yoga. And, you know, in between that, there's other threads of yoga as well. But, you know, just to say that Krishnamacharya definitely does a good job of bringing these different threads together, right? You know, yoga as a precursor to pranayama and dhyana, and yoga as a thing in itself to raise the energy in the body as a naturally to naturally experience in an embodied sense these qualities in the body. Anyway, so yeah, where does this Ashtanga come from? Because people often say, well, you know, I wish he hadn't called it Ashtanga yoga. This is, why, you know, because it just confuses people. It's not Patanjali's Ashtanga yoga. Where's all the other limbs, right? Why did Pattabhi Joyce just teach asana if he's teaching Ashtanga yoga? You know, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it's a valid point. You know, of course, it's a valid point. Where did the Ashtanga come from? I mean, we know that Krishnamacharya was very interested in the Yoga Sutras, and in his later years, he would get people to chant the Yoga Sutras, which was unusual, especially to allow Westerners to get involved in chanting texts generally, as the pronunciation wouldn't be correct, and that made a difference. So, you know, he had an interest in Krishnamacharya. This is the Yoga Sutras. Patanjali Joyce also would quote from the Yoga Sutras as well, that when Westerners first arrived in Mysore, by the way, it was just called the yoga. There wasn't a name for this practice, right? And as I said, Krishnamacharya always called it Yoga Karunta, his method, in the, back in the Mysore Palace days, right? So the Ashtanga thing seemed to come on later. And why or wherefore it was called Ashtanga Yoga, when in Patabi Joyce only ever really taught two limbs. He did teach Pranayama to those students that had completed primary and second series. But, you know, didn't seem to, in the majority of cases, teach all the eight limbs of Patanjali Yoga. And also, you know, Patabi Joyce taught it as an energetic practice. He was definitely looking at it as a, you know, he would talk about purification and blood boiling and nerve cleansing. And, you know, so he was looking at it as a practice that was not just for the sake of concentration, not just for the sake of a precursor to pranayama and withdrawal of the senses. He was looking at it, you know, Patabi Joyce was looking at it and treating it in a tantric sense as well as looking at it and, you know, as a, you know, in the dharmic sense, I suppose, as part of a whole life, right? So that thread continues. Yeah, and in my understanding of it is, you know, early days, Patabi Joyce, and this is what the teachers said to me anyway, that he would try and convey the other limbs of yoga. He would try and talk more philosophically about the text and about the context. But, you know, he had struggles with English. You know, he didn't speak good English, and he would get frustrated at that. And also, people didn't seem to be that interested, to be honest. They wanted to know how to jump back, and, you know, he would just get disappointed. So, you know, I think in the end, you know, he just kind of kept it simple and just kind of gave people a little bit what they wanted. But, you know, in the early days, I would say, you know, he did try and contextualize the asana, you know, as more of a whole rounded practice of kind of like a spiritual perspective, let's say. I don't like using the word spiritual necessarily, but, you know, a whole perspective that wasn't just, you know, yoga asana, right? So let's look at the tradition as it evolved a little bit now. So Nancy and David Williams, and Nancy Gilgoth and David Williams. Nancy just passed away, sadly. And David's still around in Hawaii. And they arrived in 1973 to Patabi Joyce. And at that time, they find a very different perspective. The yoga curriculum was on the wall of the Shala, and it did roughly show the sequences. I wrote a couple of blog posts on that, and you can see the original yoga curriculum on my blog. It did roughly show the sequences, which, as I suggested, were an innovation of Patabi Joyce with Krishnamacharya's help, probably, for the sake of the demonstrations. Anyway, at that point, Patabi Joyce was already teaching his local students. It had been for many years. I think ever since, in fact, Krishnamacharya had left for Chennai, Patabi Joyce had continued teaching at the Sanskrit College yoga and these roughly these sequences, and also from his home, from his front room. They're just local Indian, generally. No, all the time, apart from one Belgian guy that came slightly before Nancy and David and never stuck long term at it. But, you know, they were more or less the first. Yeah, they were the first serious students, along with Norman Allen, I think, who arrived a month or so earlier than them. Yeah, so Norman Allen's probably the first, let's say, and David and Nancy after that. But, you know, we know a lot more about David and Nancy's journey with it because Norman Allen was a man of few words. But now David is a man of many words, as you might know. So he'd be very very erudite and very forthcoming in his experiences, the early experiences. So what were they? Sequences was on the wall. Once you completed the four sequences, there were only four at that time. A and B was the advanced sequences. Now they were third, fourth, fifth, sixth divided up into. And the primary and the intermediate were similar with some small changes we'll come back to. But once you'd completed those sequences, you did your Rishi series. Your Rishi series was a series you were given of 15 postures that you would hold for longer periods of time. And my teacher, Mark Darby, I think he mentioned he got that in the mid-80s when he was there. That he'd gone through the sequences and then got his own series, and his wife, Joanne Darby, had also got her own series. So that's interesting, isn't it? That the sequences are meant to be graduated from. But obviously, you know, they're pretty much difficult enough that most of us will never manage to graduate from. So it's a bit of a fly in the ointment, let's say. But anyway, leaving that question of the sequences aside, and, you know, then finally graduating to play your own music, which that's up to you. Other differences are that the primary and second series were taught as one. They didn't even realize that they were two different series. They were given primary and then just added on second. Right? And it was a very quick trajectory. They weren't stopped or held back or gatekeepers or no, lie down after, you know, it was like lie down after sun salutations the first day, but then every day they would get added on more, you know, and very quickly. So after the first 2 or 3 months, I believe David told me, David Williams firsthand, and Nancy as well, that they'd got the two series together, roughly, not perfectly. Nancy was given a much more remedial version of the two series because she was not in good health at the time. She was suffering from chronic migraines. So she got, you know, she used to say to me that Batavi Joyce held her in every posture until she was strong enough to do them. So there was no stopping, no gatekeepers, as I said, just encouragement, you know. And also they could add on their own flourishes. Everyone was doing handstands at that point. If they wanted to do handstands, lifting up, challenging each other, making the postures more dynamic, you know, Saptakamasana originally was done with the legs in front of the head, you know, not behind the neck, you know. Later it was behind the neck, you know. Previously, when they arrived originally, Batavi Joyce was doing a lot less jump backs. He was encouraging a lot less jump backs between postures, but they were added in. They were the because the students wanted to do more jump backs. They wanted to lift up to handstand between the postures. They were allowed to do that. They were encouraged to do that even. So it was a different kind of vibe. I think that's the main thing to think about. There's a different kind of vibe then, you know, and I wanted to make that clear. And it's not to say that the vibe now is wrong, you know, or it's just that like there's been different approaches to the tradition. And I think it's important to know that, and that it's not never been one rigid dogma, you know. It's had various evolutions. And in the first place, Batavi Joyce called his original center Ashtanga Yoga Research Institute. And it did evolve, right? I mean, for example, the standing postures, the one where you put the leg into lotus and fold forward, Ardha Baddha Padmottanasana, and the leg raise where you're holding the toe and folding over the leg, you know, that leg raise one, Uttita Hasta Padangustasana, they came at the end of primary. And then for but a lot of it was to do with time in the end. Too many people, not enough space, not enough time. So it was easy to put them into standing rather than have people stand up and do them at the end of primary. So they were added into standing. They came at the end of primary because they're difficult postures. It makes more sense to do lotus sitting down, for example, first of all, than it does putting the lotus into standing up and then folding forward, right? Backbends didn't come until end of second series, right? So you did all of primary and then you just do the last three postures for a long time. In fact, my teacher, Darby, told me they didn't put shoulder stand and headstand on until they were well into the end of primary, right? That didn't come, just the last three postures, yeah? And you didn't do backbends, as we know them, the bridge, the wheel, Urdhva Dhanurasana. You didn't do that until the end of second. Right? So that seems to me a glaring problem these days, I would say, with the modern Ashtanga tradition as it's currently taught, because you don't get the lesser backbends, the more remedial backbends, before your full backbend. And I know putting in that start of second series, which I do with everyone, to be honest, I always put, even if they haven't completed primary, put in those early backbends of the second series. They're unchallenging, you know, Shalabhasana. I don't do Bekasana, but I do Dhanurasana, and then maybe I'll modify Ustrasana. You put them in, yeah? And then when you come to do the full backbend, you know, you can, you know, modify that if you need to, but you know, it's a lot easier. So, yeah, that seems to be the one particular issue that I would change back. But, you know, other things is like, well, you know, things change, you know, and, well, to me, there's a lot to do with self-determination here. It's like, you see the way it was, see the way it's changed, you know, and they understand that also different teachers got different things. Like it's well known that Derek Ireland got the splits between the prasaritas, the standing wide leg forward fold. He would do the splits between it. He would teach teachers, to, you know, his teachers to do this as well. So we did it for what I was taught by a precursor of Derek Ireland at his center in Crete. So the splits Hanumanasana came, you know, was put there because that was the way he was taught, or other teachers were taught different things, right? And they would, you know, because they, you know, Batavi Joyce at that time was still teaching fairly individually, right? He had his sequences, but he was way able, he was happy to bend them and modify them to suit the particular individual in front of them. So some people stayed in Baddhakonasana for minutes at a time. Some people, like Joanne Darby, stayed in headstand for an hour. Right? You know, there's lots of change, you know, kind of like changes depending on the student and innovation. I mean, Darby had this crazy story he used to tell me about how he used to lift up into handstand from a forward fold. So incredible in the first place. Then he used to go over from that into a backbend and then back over, if you can imagine this, back into the position of the primary series. So another forward fold, right? So that was the vinyasa, going up into handstand, over into backbend, back over in a tick-tock, and back in to do the next posture. And Batavi just let him do that. Just let him do that until one day he was too tired or too injured from doing that because he did hurt himself doing that. And, you know, he didn't do that. And Batavi just looks at him and just said, good. I love that story. Yeah, so you know, it was less prescriptive. I don't think there was more innovation, right? And I mean, David Williams has another story where what did he say? So the guy, I asked after the second series, after the intermediate series, what can I do more? And Pattabhi just said, oh, we'll do these 7 headstands. Apparently, they came in another series at the time, in the Advanced B series. But they were then put into the, on David Williams's request, at the end of the second series. Well, that's how things go. And of course, there were more breaths in the posture. You might know that it was 10 breaths originally, and then it was shortened to 8, and then it was 5, you know, and then we keep the 8 breaths, right, for the closing series. That's fine. You know, because it makes, I mean, they've always been very keen, the choices, on keeping the length of the closing series at least, right, to do a longer closing, right? Which is makes sense because it's very important because you're stimulating the nervous system on in the yoga practice. You're trying to calm down that nervous system for your closing. So always do a long closing, always. There were longer holds of the postures. They were breathing more basically, right? And less vinyasa, so less jumping back, right? No gatekeepers, right? Just encouraged to do more, held in postures, a modified posture and then passed over postures even. Right. Back when we're taught later, as I said, you know, so you get a feel of it. You get a feel of it. And I've talked about the initial roots of this, right, in just the innovation with Krishnamacharya trying different postures on the boys and the fact that many of these postures were not recorded in the old the text that he had, that Krishnamacharya, this is, had access to in the Mysore Palace Library. Many of these postures in the Ashtanga remit nowadays don't feature. You know, they don't feature. I mean, what you do have is texts that show or seem to show a dynamic form of posture, which is a recent innovation itself. Because if you look at the older tantric scripts, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, the Garuda Samhita, the Shiva Samhita, all these older tantric texts, they will detail a few postures, not many, and they're always static. You don't do vinyasa. And there is mention of vinyasa prior to Krishnamacharya, but it's, you know, people will argue that it's, they'll try and argue that it means the same thing, but you know, vinyasa at that point generally means following a certain ritual correctly, and more to do with mudra, yeah, and mantra than moving with breath, right? That moving with the breath and the idea of special placement, vinyasa, special placement, was to do with ritual, mantra, and mudra, and it wasn't to do with entering and exiting a posture with a breath, right? That's Krishnamacharya's use of vinyasa. So yes, the word exists. Does it mean the same thing? My experience, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, and you can tip in on this, is no. Although, you know, there are scholars that will try and find a precedent for this. One notable person who's very keen on finding ancient precedents for the use of vinyasa and Surya Namaskar, and pinning Surya Namaskar to you know, the very, very old texts. Most scholars will agree that Surya Namaskar is more of a modern innovation in itself. And obviously the vinyasa that we know that's based on Surya Namaskar then is equally modern. Some people will say it comes from the wrestling tradition of Mysore because they have something that looks a little bit similar in wrestling training. And others will point to priests' prostrations, the idea that priests do the prostrations in the temple to be like a Surya Namaskar. Yeah. You know, so they're different, you know, they're different possibilities. But let's say nothing is set in stone. Yeah, and I think that's just important to know, because then it makes you feel about this is my perspective anyway, you can take it or leave it. It makes you feel there's a tradition here, there's a tradition of general principles, and you know, and to be passed over, we have to make them appropriate, applicable, and effective to the individuals in front of us now. Yeah? You know, what their bodies are like now, what their expectations are like now, what their lives are like now, and their aims, you know, the aims of the yoga are like now. So, and any tradition that survives has to be made, you know, fresh for the modern context. You know? Otherwise, it's a dinosaur, an albatross that doesn't work anymore. And you're doing the thing correctly, or maybe you're doing the traditional thing correctly, but it doesn't have the effect. You know? At the end of the day, we've got to judge the, as I said earlier, the proof has got to be in the pudding. Does it work? You know, does it work for me in my life? In the most practical sense, not like, well, maybe it's doing something on the inside, or maybe no. Does it work now? In the most practical way that you can judge, you can say it's making things better. It's making me more comfortable. It's making me more adjusted, more balanced, you know, more thoughtful, more reflective, kinder. All these things that you could just literally say, does this tradition in the way, you know, these general principles and the way I'm applying them to my individual body, body here work? And of course, we could say, well, you know, there's more to it than that. And the repeating something together is useful, the collective idea of repetition. So, you know, you wouldn't just want to say, well, you know, this is a Krishnamacharya thing. And, you know, he just said individual based yoga and to posture, posture, counter posture and building a sequence. So then we just do whatever we want. No, I mean, I think that the sequences are good. I think repetition is good. I think for practice sake, I think it's good for binding oneself to something that one didn't choose oneself, doing something that's, you know, you didn't make up, you know, something that we all do together. You know, there's reasons why repetition and sticking to these sequences is good, but then make them your own and don't break your body to get into the perfect nature of the posture. And that, you know, leads me to the conclusion of this podcast, which I know has been a lot of my hypothesis and opinion. So, you know, please comment, you know, comment and let me know what your thoughts are, what your understanding is. And I know that other people will point to other teachers and say, well, BNS says he was taught by Krishna sequences. I'm not sure that's the case. Let's put it that way. I can't say more than that. Everyone's going to have their different take on it, and that's valid, right? And that's and I think the use of having just debunked Christmas, as it were, I think the use of the ritual and the use of the idea of the myth is useful because we're emotional beings, and you know, having just said, well, it's maybe it wasn't written on banana leaves in the caves of the Himalayas and given to Krishnamacharya by this yogi in living in the Himalayas, that myth, I have to say that was useful for me. It did drive me, and having Pip's Joyce as a figurehead before obviously the modern revelations did also motivate me, because we're emotional beings, we're not rational beings really. I think we're emotional. The last years have shown us that. So working myths, and I think we can hold a reverence, an idealization for tradition, and hold a pragmatism at the same time. Not rationally, of course, but maybe emotionally we can. We can do the two things together. Yeah. I was just going to say the thing about the idealization of the postures at the end, and the idea that, if you're doing an idealized version of the posture, that's a recent thing, because before that we didn't have the pictures, right? You know, I mean, well, I always had the pictures, roughly speaking, but they were only the line drawings. John Scott had made these line drawings, so we didn't have we didn't know the shapes of the postures. Now you'll see everyone's got their primary series. Even I've got a primary, it was me doing them. So you get the idea, the posture should be done this way, or marriage should be done this way, it should look like this way. But that's a generalization for one body, right? And I think that's fortunately and unfortunately, in the way that yoga spreads, it's got pluses and minuses. So now everyone can see the sequences very clearly. Whereas before we were looking at the line drawings of John and thinking, does the leg go there? Is that right? You couldn't see clearly, basically. And before that, obviously, David Williams he came back from Mysore just with the names of the postures. Yeah. So the representation of that posture could be very different from body to body. But now we've got this homogenization because we've got the visual context. And I think that's something to bear in mind, how that's changed the landscape, right? How now everyone should be doing this particular version of the posture, right? Regardless of their anatomy, regardless of the way that their legs are, some shorter legs, some longer legs, blah, 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 right? The anatomy of the body changes, right? And yet the posture should look like this for everyone, right? And I think that's a problem. And I think, unfortunately, and as much as you can say, it's great that we've got everyone can see it, everyone can see the charts now. I think it just makes us, again, it's treating the individual as a generalization. And anatomically, we're also different. So that means it's a separate podcast, but my idea of yoga anatomy is very, what we can actually say anatomically is very simple and very broad, really, that we don't need anatomical language for, because we're all so different. You can't really make great generalizations anatomically. You can say, don't bring the shoulder too far out of its rotational capacity for most people, right? Or don't move the knee in a way that it's got too much medial movement, right? So more lateral, more hinge joint, right? Or don't bend into your lower back, trying to spread the bend into the spine as much as you can, right? Just general, very general things, right? But, on an individual basis, we're also different. You can't say, the anatomy of the body definitely moves in this way and everyone should do the posture exactly like this, because it's simply not true. So I think that's something to be, kept in mind, that more recently, the visualization of the culture has changed the landscape and made this dogmatic homogenization of the practice in the way that it's done today. And again, the detail thing, you know, you should do it like exactly like this. This is also tightened up even in my living memory. You know, I started when I was around 20 and around 2000. I was 21 in 2000, I believe. So I might have started just before 2000. And it wasn't so tight then. There was more ability to just, oh, you know, we'd put in handstand or put in extra things or, you know, it wasn't so prescriptive. But I think as vinyasa started to encroach on Ashtanga, and as Ashtanga started to be interpreted in many ways, it kind of was necessary to say, well, this is exactly how it should be, right? You know, because now, you know, someone's going off and doing power yoga and kind of Ashtangery and kind of, you know, so, you know, it was kind of, not to say that power yoga made Ashtanga dogmatic, it didn't, but, you know what I mean? You know, there's a need to tighten up what it is and what it isn't, depending on the context that surrounds Ashtanga. And if that, as that context becomes more varied, then Ashtanga is defined in its rigidity in a way against that variation, whereas that wasn't necessary, first of all. That's an interesting kind of thing to deliberate, right? What context does to a thing. Right? I love that kind of thing. So, you know, take it or leave it. This is my spin on the modern Ashtanga tradition, and maybe I didn't say it exactly as I would have liked to have said it, but, you know, on a one-take podcast, you'll have to excuse my oversights or my repetitions, you know. Try it yourself if you want to shoot me down. It's not easy. And I've done a lot of these now, you know. So as I say, where's your Bugatti? No. Where's your podcast? No, it's a hard thing. It's a hard thing. And so just take it as you like and consider the bits you like and just throw away the rest. You know, I'm not saying this is the way that this is the take of modern Ashtanga tradition. I'm saying it's one way to look at it. It's one way to look at it from what I've assimilated and from the conversations that I've had and what I've understood from those conversations. It's not the way, obviously. Anyway, it's kind of cover my tracks. No, you know, but it's interesting to look at it and to think, you know, this is a tradition in evolution, and maybe we have more freedom to interpret the method to make it, you know, whilst preserving the essence of the Ashtanga, which is a formulaic movement of repetition based on vinyasa and based on, obviously, the Trishtana. We also, you know, should use these postures according to suit our own bodies to for pragmatic and reasonable benefit, right? It's not like, oh, we're doing this, so we're in pain, we're following it exactly, though. We've got the tradition down exactly as it should be, and we're hoping for a better future. And as I always say, if you're in pain now, you'll be in pain later. You know? So, yeah, it doesn't work. Like, it's not like something to get right. It's a ritual to be used for the process of embodiment and for the process of a greater clarity of consciousness, I suppose. The two main threads of yoga originally, if we bring it back to the start, which we see in history, for self-recognition, for consciousness to recognize itself, yeah, so restraint of the senses, this kind of attitude to use yoga, and then also for the energy to align, for alignment of energy, or for an inner adjustment of energy, so that the body energy reflects the nature of self back to oneself. So two tantric and classical, two main threads, as I can see it so far in my studies through this. Anyway, I hope you like the podcast. I could go on, but I probably won't. And yeah, if you do like it, then please remember to review us or like the podcast or however that transpires on iTunes, etc. That helps, you know. And yeah, let me know what you think in the comments. Back to a normal guest next week, so don't worry. Thanks very much for listening.